Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'll be speaking today with Joshua Goldstein, author of A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow, co-written with Stefan Quist. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on Noah's Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land, The Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist, and the show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, as well as probably about 20 other podcast sites. Now, I always throw in a quick plug for participation. Here's a few websites. If you want to get more involved in what's going on in this country, one is indivisible.us, indivisible.us. They've got about 5,000 plus local chapters, and every week they'll send you an email saying, here's what's relevant and timely that you might want to act on or make a call or that sort of thing. MoveOn.org, move on one word, a longtime digital activism site that since the 2016 election has been working more hand-in-hand with grassroots. That's national on a California basis. There's a similar organization, Courage Campaign, one word, couragecampaign.org. Similarly, digital, working hand-in-hand with grassroots. And two very specific ones, fivecalls.org. That's the number five and the word calls, fivecalls.org, that tells you timely and relevant calls you might need to make. And townhallproject1word.com, which tells you when your local representatives are holding town halls and you can go and meet with them in person. And now to today's guests. When I first became aware of the latest book by Joshua Goldstein, this one, co-written, as I said, with Stefan Quist, A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow, I was immediately interested in interviewing him. Number one, as anyone who listens to this show knows, I'm looking for solutions. Number two, climate change is perhaps the most crucial and existential problem humanity faces or perhaps has ever faced. And number three, I'm always interested in what the U.S. and its citizens can learn from other countries. I fear that Americans' sense of exceptionalism blinds them to the lessons others have learned, whether in healthcare, education, gun violence, you name it. So I look forward to learning from Goldstein how other nations had found the political will to tackle climate change. We've been hearing since the late 1980s about the difficulty that humans have bringing themselves to deal with such a distant and complex challenge. How had they overcome this obstacle? How had they successfully brought together the powerful interests of business and government at a scale and at a pace that could justify a claim that they had, quote, solved climate change? And what had they done that we in the U.S. have not been able to do, and how could that knowledge help us to catch up? Now, once I got the book and looked at its contents and messages, I realized that it talks less about those questions than about a single strategy, combining large-scale development of renewable energy resources with a quick build-out of nuclear power. Now, I confess that for a number of reasons, I've been among those who have not seen nuclear power as a prime player in our energy future. Rather, I've envisioned a combination of conservation, efficiency, decentralized renewables, and continued breakthroughs in storage as the clean energy path forward. And I also fear that I'm not sufficiently expert regarding nuclear power to be able to counter Goldstein's claims for his vision. And yet, returning to my earlier enthusiasm for learning from the examples of others, I'm going to undertake to expand my understanding in the course of our conversation. Joshua Goldstein is Professor Emeritus of International Relations at American University and Research Scholar at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's the author of the most popular textbook in the field of international relations. His book, War and Gender, won the International Studies Association Book of the Decade Award. His other books include Winning the War on War, The Decline of Armed Conflict Worldwide, The Wounds Within, The Real Price of War, and his latest, this one, A Bright Future. Welcome, Joshua Goldstein, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
It's great to be with you.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, June 11th. I'd like listeners, Joshua, to get a feel for the people, not just the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us briefly about your path to the work you do today? You know, how did you gravitate toward international relations? Why the focus on war? Why the shift? Those sorts of things. And feel free to go way back. Mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Sure. And believe me, I'm as surprised as anybody to find out that I'm working on nuclear power now, because I started out, I grew up in the Bay Area in the 60s and 70s, and I became an environmentalist right around the time of the first Earth Day, way early on. And I believed, as we all did back then, 70s environmentalists, that technology was not our friend. We wanted to go back to the land, be more natural, small is beautiful. And at the same time, we were traumatized by nuclear war. I was the generation that hid our heads under the desks to be prepared for a nuclear attack. And that's pretty traumatic. And so anything nuclear was pretty scary, and we didn't make fine distinctions between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. It was all this technology run amok that we didn't trust. So in the early 1980s, in the Reagan administration, many of us became very scared about nuclear war, and that's when I went into international relations. Before that, I was working on social justice issues. I worked with the Black Panther Party in Oakland and food co-ops and things like that. But I decided that war was the big threat to humanity, and I went to study it and to teach it and write about it. And then a funny thing happened. I had children, and my two children had a different perspective on what humanity's greatest threats were. My son in particular, when he was 11 years old, became a climate change activist, and he just saw this as his generation's issue, the issue that matters, the same way nuclear war was when I was that age. And he went on to run for the Massachusetts legislature and get elected at age 22, and he's writing a book now about climate change. But this turned me towards the issue of climate change as the new existential issue for humanity. Not that we shouldn't still be worried about nuclear war, I still am, but climate change was the big issue and one that nobody seemed to be solving at all. So I started to study that. And with an eye to not how do we take steps in the right direction, a lot of people were doing that, build renewables, eat less meat. I myself have solar cells up on my house, and I've been driving electric cars for a couple decades. And, you know, this kind of thing's all fine, but are we actually solving the problem? And there's only one metric that matters there. That's how much carbon the world is putting into the atmosphere each year. And not only is it not going down, it's still going up, and it's still going up at the same rate it's ever been. So we're just making no progress there. And so I dug into what would it take to really solve the problem, to really get the carbon emissions down very quickly, the way the UN reports are now very clearly telling us. Climate scientists are telling us by 30 years from now, we have to decarbonize and stop using fossil fuel. That's just a massive undertaking. And when I added up the numbers, it became clear that nuclear power had to be part of that solution, and we'll talk about why. But basically, it's so concentrated, and it rolls out so fast. And so then I had the attitude that I don't like nuclear power, but it looks like we're going to need it. I started to learn more about it, and I started to like it more. And I liked it more as an environmentalist because it's got such a small footprint, especially compared with coal that kills so many people and causes so much waste and such. But also compared to even renewables, which I like, but they do take their toll on the environment. You know, hydroelectricity floods ecosystems, solar cells knock out a lot of farmland and forest land, wind turbines kill birds. And nuclear power is very compact. It's very concentrated. And so it's clean from an environmental point of view as well as from a climate change point of view. And so then I wondered how this had worked historically, and I came across the example of Sweden. France is another leading example that had built nuclear reactors very quickly and decarbonized their grids. And the person who was writing about that was a young Swedish energy engineer, Stefan Kvist. So I contacted him and see if he wanted to work on the book, and he did. So that's how the book came into being.
Very good. Thank you. That's it's interesting. I often ask that question about someone's path, and yours, you know, you really let it out there that you've been moved by what's the biggest threat and what can be done about it. I would like, if you're willing, as I was researching this, I found that your earlier books had some pretty provocative titles, and I'd love it if you would be able to just tell us briefly the thesis behind some of them. War and Gender. I just look at that and I go, what is that? What were you saying in that book?
Well, when I began to study war, it was from the perspective of not a particular war or histories of wars, and certainly not strategies for winning wars, which I don't know much about, having never been in one, but from the big perspective of what role war plays in society, and how to get a handle on the big question of war. And it seemed to me that a missing piece, it's not so missing anymore, but when I wrote the book, which started in the 1990s, that very few people were talking about the role of gender in war. And yet war is the most gendered of human activities, just about, with a couple of exceptions, childbirth. And yet we didn't talk about it in terms of gender. So that was interesting to me, and I wanted to see what role did gender play in making the war system what it is today in the world. What I learned that was especially interesting, and I didn't expect, was the role that war plays in shaping the gender system as we live it now, because every society is preparing for the possibility of fighting a war at some time, potentially, and we raise boys and girls in different ways to meet the needs.
How about winning the war on war, the decline of armed conflict worldwide, which psychologist Steven Pinker led him to his book on the Better Angels. With the U.S. waging a seemingly endless war in Afghanistan, the conflict in Iraq hardly successfully concluded, somewhere between 700 to 800 military bases worldwide the U.S. holds. Is there good news that we don't hear enough about?
Yes, and this is exactly a case of what you said in the intro, that the United States sometimes pays too much attention to ourselves. So the decade after 9/11, the early part of this century, the United States became more warlike, obviously, and got involved in this endless war that's still going on. And that was a clear trend in that direction for the United States. But we didn't notice that in the rest of the world, the trend was running strongly in the opposite direction. After the world wars, we dropped down into the Cold War period, which was less violent. And when the Cold War ended, we dropped down to a still less violent world where a lot of big wars that had taken so many lives and caused so much destruction ended and were not replaced by an equal number of big wars. Specifically, and this is overlooked a lot, the world's standing armies, the regular uniformed armies that states have, there's 20 million people in them. They have a mass of weapons of all kind, airplanes, submarines, tanks, guns, and we're all armed to the teeth. But it used to be those armies would fight each other regularly, usually several of those going on at once in history. And those are the big wars that kill and destroy the most. Iran, Iraq, India versus Pakistan, the Korean War, the Vietnam War. So what's happened since the Cold War is that those have died out almost entirely now. The last one was the brief period when the United States invaded Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And before that, it was the Ethiopia-Eritrea War, which is almost 20 years ago now. So now we have a world armed to the teeth in which the big armies aren't fighting each other anymore. And we're left with grinding civil wars between a government on one side and some kind of forces on the other side, sometimes with international intervention in them, but never at that scale of the big international wars.
Okay. And then the book where I think the wages of war became more personal, the book The Wounds Within, The Real Price of War.
Yeah, this actually started with the gender book because in looking at the relation between men and war, one is drawn to the topic of psychological trauma. And I had an old friend who was a trauma therapist and had worked with one particular Marine who was one of the first deployed to Iraq, came back traumatized, did not get the help that he needed despite his family's great efforts, and ended up killing himself. And this was his story, his family's story, and then the kind of general backstory of a country that goes off to war, throwing large numbers of people into a terrible traumatic situation and not being prepared for them to come home and heal again.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that I hear is, as you get into a book like that, and you're talking about one particular story, tracing one person's experiences, you're definitely moving away from academic writing. And to even be able to do that, you definitely have shifted into writing for the popular culture. Would that be right?
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm trying to reach a bigger audience now that's off campus, and there's nothing wrong with academic work. I've been around it all my life. I grew up on a university campus, but you know, it is a limited number of people that ever read your work in those circles, and so I think it's very useful to take what people have learned in academia and try to educate a broader public about it.
So this book begins with the questions you were asking, you know, how large is the threat of climate change? What are we doing to stop it? What do we need to do? What's missing? Those sorts of questions. And you end up with basically, as I said, and as you've alluded to, build out renewables as quickly as you can, but to take coal plants offline quicker, replace some of that energy with nuclear so that you, you advocate for that mix. Is that a fair statement?
That's right. The piece that you're not quite capturing is just the vast amount of clean, cheap, scalable electricity that we'll need by mid-century, because electricity is only one quarter of the global carbon emissions, even though it gets most of the attention. And another quarter is agriculture and land use and forestry, which I don't really deal with, but it has to be part of the solution for sure. Mm-hmm. But then there's another half that is fossil fuels used in industry, transportation, heating buildings, and a few other little things. And so in the next 30 years, while we're cleaning up our electric grid, we need to electrify all of those things, either directly like electric cars, or indirectly, like making aviation fuel from some substitute process that all starts with clean electricity and ends up with the various end uses that we have. And that's a way to get fossil fuels out of the system. So there's a lot of technology work that has to happen over on that side, but it has to be fueled by cheap electricity, clean electricity that's not emitting carbon.
Yes.
And then, at the same time, that whole pie is growing because most of the energy demand in the world now is in the poorer countries, and it's growing the fastest there. And that's places where people's lives are improving from access to energy, and it is their human right to have access to energy. You know, there's a billion people not on the grid, and the people want air conditioning in heat waves. This is life-saving stuff. So those countries, India, Indonesia, you know, the big kind of China's a special case and very important, but right behind China are a lot of big, poor countries that are getting their feet under them, lifting people out of poverty, and they're doing it right now on the back of coal. So we need something to replace coal that can grow really fast if we're going to have any hope of meeting that demand.
Right. And I think you actually lay out even greater demand than what you've already talked about. So one is the demand that we currently see times population, sort of. And then there's the things which are not electrified, which will have to be. I must say, it's interesting. I lived in a home recently that was a model home. Originally built in the early 50s, and its claim was, wow, all electric oven, all electric heating. And we went away from that, and now we're going to have to return to that. But another one is that merely doing all of that won't be enough, that we have to draw down carbon from the atmosphere. That there's that in addition, correct? And that's going to take more power.
Well, we're going to take new technology. I mean, we can do it now, but it's ridiculously expensive. So we need new technology to do it cheaper, but for sure it's going to take a lot of energy to do it. And I could add to that desalination of salt water, seawater, because the world has rising need for water and we're running short in many places. So that, too, if you have a lot of cheap electricity, you can make clean water from seawater. So you add it all up, we're going to need something like as much as 8 times the electricity that we're generating now in the world. And 80% of what we're generating now almost is from fossil fuels. So you have to replace all that and then multiply it quite a few times. And that's the problem. It's just people understand that it's an urgent problem and a serious problem with climate change, but I don't think very many people have really figured the scale of it.
Right. And so what's happening is as conditions actually with climate change, conditions will increase the need for power, for instance, air conditioning in countries that have little of it and that sort of thing, and will demand that increased power be carbon-free.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, let me just ask one thing so that I don't miss it, as we move through other areas. But this thing of drawing down carbon, which you say will take new technologies, what about the role of regenerative agriculture? That we went from a kind of agriculture to very industrial agriculture. Industrial agriculture does not draw down that much carbon, but regenerative agriculture has the potential to draw down quite a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean that's important, but it's part of a whole suite of solutions on the agricultural side, which are not my focus, but have to be part of the solution. Those include the new methods of agriculture, no-till agriculture and mm-hmm. things like that. It includes reducing deforestation, which has proved to be pretty hard to do so far, but we need to do it. And then afforestation, where we're planting a lot more trees, and a series of other things having to do with how the whole agriculture and land use sector works. And that is right now, that's our best method of capturing carbon from the atmosphere as a tree.
It's photosynthesis.
So we need more of them. But in addition, there are companies that are several of them that have proven the concept of running big fans and capturing carbon that way. Mm-hmm. And also you can capture from the ocean where carbon is 100 times more concentrated than the atmosphere. And that's another potential way to go. All of these things on the technology side tend to just cost money and they don't produce useful products, although there are some things you can make with that carbon captured from the atmosphere, plastics and things like that. But they tend to be more expensive to do that way than to just pump more fossil fuel out of the ground.
Right. So you're pointing out that this thing, that there's going to be this whole sector that in some ways the market will have trouble producing for us since it doesn't produce products, since it's just remediation on a massive scale.
That's right. So we need markets. We need market solutions where possible, and especially this backbone of cheap electricity that's going to compete with fossil fuels in the poorer countries where they're not going to pay a premium. And then we need policies such as, mandates for electric vehicles like Norway is doing now. And then we need new technology to make things feasible in 10 or 20 years that are not. Now, so this is it's a multi-front thing. My son's book, The 100% Solution, goes over all of that ground, but my focus is just the electricity sector.
What's your response to Drawdown, Paul Hawkins' book, researching 80 existing solutions and 20 solutions coming down the pike?
It's a great example of steps in the right direction. There's a lot of good solutions there. It's hard to argue with them. They're things we should do. But in the end, even the authors of the book admit that it doesn't really add up to a solution. So I'm trying to go top down. What do we need to do to solve the problem? Not what steps, we'll each do our part and we'll do what we can and then we'll hope it adds up. Well,
right.
It isn't adding up. That's really clear now. This isn't adding up. We need a a pretty radical change of direction if we're going to get our arms around this problem.
It's interesting. You called that top down. What I actually like is I wouldn't have called it top down. I would say stepping into the future you want and then asking, how did we get there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the same thing, really.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the world of 2050, what does it look like? And what it looks like is it has to not be using fossil fuels, and that means that we have to have technologies that can be based on electricity instead, directly or indirectly. That means that we have to generate that electricity in much larger quantities and cleanly, and so you kind of work back from where you want to get to.
Yeah, no, I think that is the way to go, that if you work forward, what you present yourself with is today's problems, today's obstacles. You got to deal with them eventually, but to really see the path forward, I think you have to look from where you, from the desired end, and then look back, and then the obstacles aren't the things that'll stop you; they're just things that you got to deal with along the way. Are the countries that you cite, for instance, Sweden and France, are they continuing to build new nuclear power plants, or did they manage to build them so aggressively earlier that they're now shifting to renewables? And if they are continuing to build them, are they running into problems they didn't face first time around?
They're not continuing to. Well, France is building some. Sweden is not. They built them several decades ago. In France's case, it was in large part response to the oil crises in the Middle East and the desire for energy self-sufficiency, which, if you're old enough, you remember that was a big thing back then.
Yeah.
In Sweden's case, the environmentalists were demanding that hydroelectricity stop expanding in order to save the last free-flowing rivers in Sweden. So that actually was an environmental demand for nuclear power. But in both cases, they just set about building one after the other. And in 15 years, France just took fossil fuel from the majority of their electricity production to less than 10%, and nuclear the other way, from almost nothing up to 75% of all their electricity. And then they've just both kind of stayed there since then. Sweden right now is having a huge debate about whether to how much renewables to put in. They're building wind. But Sweden has hydroelectric, which is good for building wind and solar. Solar's not very good if you're as far north as Sweden, but wind is good. So you can balance it with hydroelectricity. The big flaw with renewables, and this isn't really what your question was, maybe we'll get into it later, but the big flaw with renewables is that we don't have storage. There's no storage in sight that's going to fill in for them. So hydroelectric power can fill that gap. Natural gas can fill that gap, but it's ruining the climate while it does, and nuclear power can do it.
Natural gas, it's a well-coined term, but basically natural gas is methane, right?
Yes, natural gas is methane gas with the word natural in front of it.
Yeah!
It's really great marketing.
Yep, I agree. And methane.
The trouble with methane gas is, I mean, there's two troubles. One is, although it emits carbon at only half the rate of coal, and that's like a step in the right direction, that's still emitting carbon every time you fire up natural gas. So it's not a route to decarbonization, which is where we get rid of the carbon emissions in 30 years. And the second and more serious problem is that it leaks along the way, all the way from the wellhead to the burner at the other end, all through the pipeline system, et cetera. It leaks unburned into the atmosphere, and when it does, it's a greenhouse gas that's 80 times stronger than carbon dioxide on the relevant time frame of this next few decades. And so it's unclear whether this shift from coal to natural gas, yes, it's reducing CO2, but it's also putting a lot more methane up. And we're a little late on to the game on methane, measuring it, handling it, et cetera, but as science is catching up, it's clear that the methane concentrations in the atmosphere are going up pretty alarmingly now.
Yeah. Okay. So let me tell people, by the way, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Joshua Goldstein, about his book, A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow, and a couple of websites to learn more. One is Bright Future Book, one word, brightfuturebook.com, and then Joshua has his own website, joshuagoldstein.com, which overlaps with the Bright Future, but also other work he's done over the years. It sounds to me like both Sweden and France, for instance, did their changes not to respond to climate change. They did it before the real understanding of climate change had emerged. So have there been countries that have followed suit in response to climate change?
Not so much, not the way that I would like to see. Ontario province in Canada, which is to say Toronto and surroundings, is now decarbonized, and they did that with nuclear power. Most of it was not as long ago as Sweden and France, but a little while ago, and then more recently they upgraded the nuclear power to knock coal off the grid altogether, and that was a positive example. South Korea's been building nuclear reactors really quickly, and they're actually the best in the world at the current technology that we have, building quickly and cheaply. In fact, electricity from nuclear power is 3.5 cents a kilowatt hour in South Korea, which is, you know, cheap as natural gas here, pretty much the same. But then before the last presidential election in South Korea, there was this film in the theaters about a nuclear disaster, fictitious, actually ridiculous nuclear disaster, but it scared everybody a lot. And the president who was elected, President Moon, took an anti-nuclear position, and then they're trying to sort it out now. And right now where they are is they're continuing to build the reactors that were under construction, but they've slowed down their future plans. So the whole thing's up in the air quite a bit in the world. And I should mention China, because that's really the most important place. And just to jump to the end of that, China is right now on the fence about nuclear power. They're building out supply chains, just kind of setting up for a big rollout if they decide to go that way, but they haven't committed to it either. So that's going to be tremendously important. China uses half the coal in the world. China emits more carbon emissions than the United States and the European Union combined now. And if you look at a graph of it, it just shoots up after 2001 when China joined the World Trade Organization. The reason is that the industrialized countries like ourselves have shipped all our manufacturing over to China in that period, and we've essentially outsourced our carbon emissions. So ours kind of trend down, China's go shooting up, and the world isn't really making progress that way. But China is also suffering greatly from its coal, because coal produces particulate matter in the air that people breathe, and it makes them sick with emphysema, cancer, heart disease, terrible diseases. And around the world, it kills about 1 million people every year. So this is a no-brainer to get rid of coal. If you were charging the cost of the health effects of coal on the price of generating electricity with coal, it would not be competitive at all. But we do that in two separate compartments. Anyway, China has a big incentive to get off of coal in order to clean up the air in its cities, which is a really serious problem. And they could do that with about 600 new nuclear reactors. And if they did what France did and built them out quickly, they could do that in about 15, 20 years. That action alone would reduce world carbon emissions by about 12%. So it would be a big step. Not everything, you know, but that's a good place to start. That's the low-hanging fruit. China, take coal off the grid, 600 reactors. And they have a reactor that they've just building the first one now. They're exporting it to Argentina and Pakistan. It's a good workhorse, latest generation reactor, and they could just roll that out very quickly the way France and Sweden did several decades ago.
And one thing that would allow them to do that and roll it out quickly is the fact that they don't, being an authoritarian country, the government can say, this is what we're doing, and we're doing it at this pace, and we're investing this much in it, and so on, in a way that that things are much more contested in a place like the U.S.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the Chinese government or President Xi, but in this particular aspect, it does allow them to move quickly if they want to.
So now, in China, you were saying that if they were to adopt kind of what you're recommending, that over, in the next 20 to 30 years, it could make a huge difference. Currently, according to the International Energy Agency's tracking for the generation mix, is that in 2016, nuclear is 2%, and by 2040, it's only 4%. So that's what you're saying about them being on the fence.
Yeah, they just haven't decided if they're going to scale it back, roll it out, keep it about where it is. And this has been hanging for a couple of years. They have just built some new reactors, including the AP1000 Westinghouse reactor, same design we're trying to build in Georgia, and just having a terrible time. It's horribly over budget and behind schedule, and just, you know, you could never move forward on that kind of basis to decarbonize with nuclear power. But China just built four of them and put them on the grid in less than a year. They built them in a few years, and apparently on budget, too. So they can do this much cheaper than the United States can. South Korea can build a reactor for about one-sixth of what these Georgia things are costing. So it's, and France has half the electricity price that Germany does. Sweden also, it was very cheap when they did it back then.
Right.
There's nothing inherent in nuclear power that makes it expensive, but the way we're doing it in the United States and Europe now has become too expensive to work, no doubt about that.
And so implicit, buried in your recommendation, is that whole calculus that currently exists around the cost of building, because as I think even there were under Obama's Nuclear Regulatory Agency, they okayed four, but two of them are not being built, and two of them are behind schedule and over budget. Is your hope that if such a decision were made, whatever the shift in psychology and political will and everything happened, that what's creating those huge costs could be changed? I mean, what's your thinking about that? Because obviously, we were just contrasting. China can say we're doing it and it gets done. Here it's much messier. How do you imagine that financial question changing so drastically that they become affordable and it's a different reality?
Yeah. So the key to getting costs down on nuclear power, and this is what France did, is to standardize a design and build it repeatedly. I mean, like, imagine if you built one iPhone and put it up for sale. You know, it would be really expensive. So you have to build a bunch of them, and the cost comes down as you reproduce a product and roll it out. France did this with a standardized design, and actually the head of our U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission a few decades ago made the joke that the difference between France and the United States is, in France, they have two types of reactor and 100 kinds of cheese.
Right.
In the United States, it's the other way around.
Right.
You know, so what we did with these new reactors, we didn't build anything for 30 years. We lost a whole generation of trained people. Then we came up with new designs, which on paper were better, but had never been built before. And then we had, meanwhile, a lot of new regulations, a lot of heightened safety regulation. And then when they started building them, right away was the Fukushima accident, which we can talk about, but the upshot of it here was to add more regulations, change design while construction was going on. And then on top of all that, we're just not very good at these big concrete-laying infrastructure projects anymore. I'm not sure why, but the California High-Speed Rail is a good example, or the Tappan Zee Bridge, new bridge. They all seem to go way over budget.
The big dig
and
in
way
Boston,
behind schedule.
Right?
Yeah, the big dig in Boston, exactly. What you need for nuclear power is to build them centrally and ship them to where they're going. And there's a couple of ways to do this. One is to make them a lot smaller and build them in factories and ship them out on trucks. But the one I find most promising is to build them in shipyards. Shipyards are very good at repetitive build of large complex structures and just shaving the cost down. That's what they do. The most advanced shipyards in the world are in South Korea, where you already have the most advanced nuclear reactors, so that's convenient. And then you build them in the shipyard and float them to where they're going, and either anchor them in the seabed just offshore, or float them just offshore, or pull them up to dock, or in some way site them at the receiving end. And then you can build a lot of them in a row, bring the cost down continuously, and ship them out around the world. And that's the secret to get a lot of affordable nuclear power on the world grid quickly.
Okay. I read in an interview, you didn't use the example of the iPhone when you were using the example of choosing one design and building it repetitively as a way to cut costs. And I'm going to read what you said. You said, somebody's got to innovate. The goal is to make these less like building a complicated bridge and more like stamping Boeing jetliners as they come off an assembly line. I can see why you didn't use the Boeing jetliner example today, given what's happened to the 737 MAX recently. But
No, that's still a great example. And the 737 MAX is a great case of the difference between jetliners and nuclear plants, where we need to be more like jetliners, and that is that we didn't all stop flying when two planes crashed.
That's right.
You build them, you make them as safe as possible, and when one crashes, then you investigate, you figure out what went wrong. Maybe you need to change the corporate culture or the safety standards or the specific design, the pilot training. They figure that out. We keep flying, and it gets safer and safer over time as we do, but still, every once in a while, a plane falls out of the sky and everybody dies. But flying is very important and very convenient, so we keep doing it, even though it's scary, inherently scary, to go up in an airplane for many people. Nuclear plants, it's like if anything goes wrong at one, then it's like, we can't use nuclear power. Look at Fukushima. Well, let's look at Fukushima. Nobody died from radiation at Fukushima. It actually proved how safe nuclear power is. Because
isn't the word
natural disaster, the fourth worst earthquake in history of the world, and a 50-foot tsunami, and then it hit the plant, and the generators were in the wrong place, and the backup power was lost, and the core melted down, the hydrogen exploded, everything went wrong.
Right.
And yet the radiation that the public was exposed to was below the safety levels that we set for medical and occupational exposure. A small number of people who were in the plant working on it were exposed to higher radiation, but none of them died. So this is an example of, if one plane crashes, we keep flying, we try to make it better. And if one nuclear power plant has an accident, we need to do the same thing. Nobody can tell you, and I certainly won't, that we're going to build out a lot of nuclear power plants in the world and never have an accident. We are going to have accidents, and quite possibly people will die. They didn't at Fukushima, but they did at Chernobyl. Some people, 100 people maybe. But this is against the backdrop of 1 million people a year that coal smoke is killing, and billions people in the poorer parts of the world who want more energy but don't want to die of coal smoke, and then billions of people who are going to be affected by climate change if we don't get on top of the problem. So, if 100 people die in an accident, or there's an accident that scares everybody and nobody dies, which was Fukushima, that you can't change the course of your plan to solve climate change because of those things. And yet we're so panicky about it.
Okay.
And it's so badly understood that that's what we seem to do.
So don't you think that with Fukushima you have to say yet because of the cancers that may well come from the radiation, and the fact that even today the problem of the water and so on hasn't been solved?
Well, the problem of the water and so on is a problem of that radioactivity is being added to the environment at above the level of zero. This goes to the misunderstanding of radioactivity and hence of safety. But before I go into that, anybody can look up the UN reports about Fukushima. This was extensively studied by the expert people like the UN Committee on the Scientific Study of Atomic Radiation, the World Health Organization, et cetera. And they concluded that any rise in cancer rates from radiation would be so minimal that you wouldn't be able to distinguish it from the background variation. I mean, yes, somebody might die, a few people might get cancer that wouldn't have, but it's nowhere near the big causes of cancer. Coal, you know,
right.
Smoking,
no.
Things like that.
Right.
So the radiation issue is really vexing because people feel like radiation is number one, that the tiniest amount of it will cause irreparable harm, which is clearly not true because we live in a soup
right.
of background
right.
radiation
yeah.
all the time.
Yeah.
It varies from one place to another on Earth. It's about, the unit is millisieverts of radiation exposure by a human, and we get about 3 of those a year in normal background. But if you live at altitude, like in Denver, then it goes up to about 5, and if you
mm-hmm.
smoke, it's
yep.
maybe 9,
yep.
and
yep.
Working airline
yeah.
routes on the crew,
I got it.
You're exposed to more radiation, et cetera. So there are places on the world where it's as high as 200, but we set a level of 50 as the occupational limit if you work in an industry, medical, nuclear power, anything that uses radiation. And that's the limit that was never exceeded in Fukushima. Now, you can track very low levels of radiation. You can track a plume of radiation from the Fukushima power plant across the Pacific Ocean and onto California. But the levels are so small, they're not harming anything or anyone. And yet our instruments are so precise that we can measure that.
Okay.
The second thing about radiation is that, and this was just came up in the new Chernobyl documentary,
mm-hmm.
people think it's like a contagious virus. That
mm-hmm.
if somebody's, the firefighter went into Chernobyl, comes out, and then they're radioactive. It's like a zombie situation. You know, the zombie bites another person, and then they become a zombie. It's not like that at all. It's a one-shot thing. The firefighter gets radiated, has whatever health effects come from that, gets washed off, and it's not going to hurt anybody else.
Yeah.
It doesn't go out.
Yeah.
It's not like a virus that has to be contained.
Joshua, I'm not that interested yeah. in your dispelling straw men because we only have 10 minutes left.
Okay.
So the reason...
But this is
that,
what
wait.
I constantly hear from people. That,
well, but you didn't hear it from me.
Get radiation down to zero, we can't use nuclear power.
Yeah, so. That isn't what you heard from me, so let's stick to this conversation.
The
reason that I raised Boeing was not because people stopped flying, but because it appears in the early investigations that there was, even though they were dealing with the lives of hundreds of people and the future of their company, that there were mistakes were made, that people weren't trained adequately, budgets, corners were cut. The reason that I mention it is because of that. Because when you're dealing with something, that has the potential destructive capacity of nuclear energy, you've got to, I'm just saying, who's going to, and I will let you answer this one. Who are you confident will not make those same kind of mistakes, or why are you confident those people won't make those same kind of mistakes? And I'm going to ask two other questions to set this one up. One is, since the waste won't degrade for anywhere from 10,000 plus years, how can we be certain that even if we sighted Yucca Mountain and it were buried deeply there and so on, that the kinds of responsible agencies, whether private or government, will be around 100 years, 150 years. And finally, why isn't the insurance industry willing to cover the liability? Why has a federal law been on the books since 57 limiting the dollar liability of nuclear companies? So that is a package of questions. How do you get past the fact that humans seem to screw up? How do we know that in the developing world and so on, where governments might be more unstable, that there's going to be the kinds of regulation and oversight that we need? And why isn't the insurance industry willing to insure?
Yeah, so people do screw up, and they will screw up in the nuclear power industry, especially if we roll out a lot of it. As I said, there will be accidents. In terms of the waste, We can't ensure that it remains completely isolated for hundreds of thousands of years. But here's the thing. Let's not call it hundreds of thousands. Just say it remains toxic forever, because that's, okay, you know, on the time scale we're dealing with. Remains toxic forever. So what do we do with coal waste? It has arsenic, mercury, and lead in it. They all remain toxic forever. They're elements. They will be toxic hundreds of thousands of years from now, and yet we just dump them into these pools by the side of the river in a cavalier manner, and it's what we're doing with most industrial waste. Nuclear waste is no more harmful than these other wastes. The difference is, and this is the good thing, it's so much smaller in quantity because nuclear is so concentrated, and this is why nuclear can roll out fast. It's why it's potentially affordable, because the fuel is so concentrated, and it's why the waste stream is so small. If you took all the American spent fuel from our whole nuclear power program, 60 years, and put it in one place, it would fit into a Walmart. So, you know, coal waste is tens of thousands of times that much, and we just put it around everywhere. So when you say it has to remain completely contained, that's an example of thinking that radiation is vastly destructive in tiny quantities, and that's not the case. Finland is building a repository for their nuclear waste, and they studied what would happen if everything went wrong and it leaked and the casks were already cracked before they went in there, et cetera. And then 1,000 years from now, somebody lived their whole life on 1 meter of land, with getting all their food and water from there, the most contaminated meter of land there. How much radiation would they get? And it was about equal to eating a bunch of bananas, which are slightly radioactive because they have potassium in them. So the amounts of radiation are very small. The amount of waste is very small. This is an easy problem to manage. It's literally a small problem. The problem of people screwing up, you're not going to fix. And you have to take the attitude that the airline industry does, which is to come in and fix things when they do screw. You know, make your best effort. Try to keep it as safe as possible. But the bottom line with nuclear power is that we know now what I didn't know in the 1970s when I didn't like it. Then it was new. We didn't know how dangerous it would be, and our imaginations filled that gap. Now we have 60 years of experience, and we know we've had one serious fatal accident in Chernobyl, several freakouts that didn't kill anyone, and the overall rate of safety of nuclear power is hundreds of times better than coal, and actually better than any other fuel source. Even hydroelectric power, which, as you mentioned, killed tens of thousands of people in China in the 1970s, just about the same, you know, not that far off from when Chernobyl happened. The Bhopal disaster with chemicals in India happened right at the same time as Chernobyl, and nobody even remembers it anymore, and it was 10 times worse. And we didn't stop using chemicals. So things will screw up. People will die. And that's all on one side of the balance. And on the other side is billions of people who are going to inherit an uninhabitable planet if we don't solve climate change. And you're not going to get zero risk, but you can make sensible decisions that leave us the best possible future.
Okay. And what about the insurance industry? And the government backing, yeah, you know, putting the ultimate liability on citizens.
Yeah, that's a specific thing in the United States. I will say that nuclear power it requires a lot of upfront money to build, because it's a big infrastructure. And normally, either governments do it, like in France, the government itself did it. In Sweden, it was kind of a public-private thing. Here we have the idea that everything should be done on the private marketplace. And for a big project like that, and with a lot of potential for litigation and you know, expenses if anything goes wrong, above and beyond what the real expenses are, you're going to multiply that because everybody's going to panic and litigate, et cetera. And so the government provides the backstop for that on the insurance side of it. You can't build any really big infrastructure. You can't do the California high-speed rail by turning it over to private companies and then asking an insurance company to bail it out if something goes wrong.
So it's the you're saying the scale, not the fact that it's nuclear.
I think that's right.
Okay, let me ask you in the last 2 minutes, Joshua, to what what, because you I've seen you do it in the book and in other interviews and articles, the set of recommendations, because it isn't that your whole thing is build nuclear. So what's Joshua Goldstein's analysis of our best approach starting today?
Yeah, we need to do everything, and we need to do it really fast. We need to put a price on carbon emissions. That's very important because it acts quickly and it goes across the whole economy, that you can't just dump your coal smoke into the air for free. We need to change agricultural practices. As we said, we need to develop the new technologies that will let us electrify building heat, you know, air source heat pumps, electric vehicles, substitute diesel fuel, and all of those technologies. And then we need to build on the electric side as much clean electricity as we can, as fast as possible. By the way, on the technology side, I also think we do need to put money into the technology of energy storage. You can't count on a miracle of energy storage. We did a study of the European continent. My co-author had the data that showed that for an entire week out of 1 year, Europe, the whole continent, didn't have solar and didn't have wind. So we just don't have that kind of storage. It's nowhere in sight to back that up. And then you need an entire backup system of some kind if you're trying to put all your eggs in the renewables basket. So I'm saying build all the renewables you can, do all the energy efficiency you can, but in addition, build out all the nuclear power that you can. That's really great. If we can build these floating reactors in South Korean shipyards, that's really good. If somebody can build them some other way anywhere else, India will probably have a different route. I think Indonesia has another. We haven't talked about, and should just mention, that there's a whole slew of startups now that are working on new nuclear reactor designs, smaller, cheaper, inherently safer, even safer. And some of those may come to fruition. We should also be backing those in the new technology side of things.
So what you're saying, and let me see if I've got this right, is that currently, if you went all renewable, you'd be backing it up with fossil fuel. And nowadays, that's primarily coal. And what you're saying is, since it will probably take 10 years to build some new plants, that even if we went to your plan today, that 10 years from now, we could be backing up the renewables that we've built out with nuclear instead of with coal.
Right. We can build out nuclear right now. We have the technology. We know it works. France did it in 15 years. You know, it's been done. It's proven.
So some people talk about natural gas as a transition. What you're saying is nuclear could be the backup that would cover us for intermittent renewables.
Yeah. Okay. Natural gas sells itself as the perfect partner for renewables.
Right.
And what scares me about the renewables, when the first 10-20% that goes on the grid doesn't bother me at all. In fact, it's great. In fact, I've got it on my rooftop. When you talk about we're going to go to 60, 80, 100% renewables, that's always gone with a backup of natural gas, and it never gets to 60% because the gas kicks in that often. And then you've got the methane leaks, and it's kind of a bridge to nowhere is how I see it.
We've got to come to an end here. So the book is A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. The websites are brightfuturebook.com and joshuagoldstein.com. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. Terrence McNally, one word, A World That Just Might Work, one word. If you want to receive a weekly email announcement of telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, plus usually 8 or 10 articles, timely and relevant, then sign up at my website or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Free Forum Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud. You can find years of podcasts at my site. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, etc. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And thank you, Joshua Goldstein. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, thanks so much for doing your podcast and having these conversations. It's been great to be with you.